Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. There is another healthcare crisis in this country. Not only are there many people lacking access to care, most people, including doctors and scientists, aren't even getting all the information. When information's controlled by market forces, only the information that improves the bottom line will be tolerated. Research seems to contradict itself because often the conclusions of the studies don't jive with the results. And studies are set up to have pre-concluded outcomes based on who's footing the bill. You might think I'm cynical, but an increasing number of professionals who have devoted their lives to keeping up with what they believed was reliable information agree, and they're writing books about it. Today I'm joined by Harvard Medical School faculty member physician Dr. John Abramson. His book is Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. The Baltimore Sun carried an article last week titled, Learning the Hard Lessons of Vioxx. All drugs pose risks, experts warn, and newest products demand extra caution. The gist of the article is that, despite what you might think the FDA is supposed to be doing regarding drug safety, you're pretty much on your own. There's a concept in economics for this. Caveat emptor. Buyer beware. The article reports that experts say doctors and patients need to understand that approval by the FDA has very limited meaning. The FDA approves drugs with benefits that seem to outweigh the risks based on very limited clinical trials. Long-term risks are complete unknowns. And as we know, in many cases such as Vioxx, known risks are sometimes actively suppressed by the drug companies. These experts also say we can't really expect the FDA to do much given their congressional mandate, and we certainly can't expect the drug companies to do anything given the demands of competition. So that leaves you and me and our physicians holding the bag, according to these experts. Who are these experts? Former FDA officials who now work as lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry. I'm not making this up. The big news in reform reported by The Sun is that a great congressional upwelling of indignation might put limits on advertising drugs to consumers, but only new drugs, and only for the first year, maybe. The article is silent on reforms that affect physicians, despite a recent editorial piece in the Public Library of Science by a former editor at the British Medical Journal titled, Medical Journals Are an Extension of the Marketing Arm of Pharmaceutical Companies. To cut to the chase, we are all contaminated by the oil slick of drug money. Tinkering with advertising is close to laughable. The problem here is much more fundamental. The public has a great interest in what drug companies do. That's how we justify the FDA. But the drug companies can devote a lot more attention to the FDA than you or me or our doctors can. Let me introduce another concept from economics which I think explains itself, regulatory capture. How is it that drug companies have more money than God? Because they pack huge research and development costs into their price and are able to charge for it based on exclusive rights under U.S. patent law. And most of that R&D is for variations on old themes, not for genuinely new pharmacology. Maybe it's just because I'm a political economist, but the solution here seems obvious to me. Instead of more regulation, the answer is, first, have all drug research and development conducted by public agencies and universities. Second, place the science in the public domain. And third, license drug making to the drug companies. The FDA's approval of a drug would be entirely separate from the fortunes of the drug companies. Right. Unthinkable. So, back to holding the bag. You don't have to take the bag that's handed to you. You can make drugs the last, not the first thing on the list of what you do about your health. Instead of insisting that your doctor give you the drug you just saw on TV, insist that he or she find a non-pharmaceutical solution. And of course, you're a citizen. Vote for people who will do more than limit ads for new drugs. 20 years ago, single-payer health care was unthinkable. Now it's very thinkable. Why not public pharmaceuticals? For a transcript of this editorial, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org and go to the radio show page. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist and health educator who co-produces the radio show and manages the operations of the newly formed nonprofit Your Own Health and Fitness. You can reach him by going to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or you can call him directly at 707-874-1496. And now to our guest, author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine, How the Pharmaceutical Companies Are Corrupting Science, Misleading Doctors, and Threatening Your Health, Dr. John Abramson, currently on the clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School, where he teaches primary care. A former Robert Wood Johnson's fellow, Abramson has worked as a family doctor in Appalachia and in Hamilton, Massachusetts. He served as chairman of the Department of Family Medicine at Leahy Clinic and was twice voted best doctor in his area by readers of the local newspaper and three times selected by his peers as one of the best family practitioners in Massachusetts. I'm so pleased to have you with us, Dr. Abramson.
Lena, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes. By what shall I call you?
As you feel comfortable.
Well, what are you comfortable with?
You can call me John.
John, thank you. I will. You can call me Lena.
Great. All right. Good. I like that.
You're in very good company with this book. As you know, there are many other books that came out just about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What's different with yours is that it draws on your very personal experience in your medical practice and a certain betrayal that I think you feel as a member of the medical establishment and as a doctor who loves medicine and treasures the doctor-patient partnership.
Absolutely. And what Dr. Fawcett was talking about in the editorial really was a key turning point in my career. When I understood that the article that had been in the New England Journal of Medicine supposedly describing Merck's big study of Vioxx, was just plain wrong about its conclusions and was misleading doctors into using Vioxx, making doctors believe or leading doctors to believe that Vioxx was a safer drug than naproxen, when in fact it was a more dangerous drug than naproxen. When I understood that, and a similar thing with Celebrex, that Celebrex had been misrepresented in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and my patients, who I had taken care of for years in this small town, were coming into me requesting and demanding these drugs because they had seen the advertisements. And I couldn't convince my own patients that these drugs were being misrepresented. When I understood that, I realized that to meet the goals that set me in the direction of being a family doc, the best thing to do was to devote myself to researching this situation, to understanding what's going on, and explaining it to the American public. If I could have written a book for doctors, I would have. But doctors weren't ready 3 years ago to understand how much the information that they have been taught to trust has been taken over by corporate interests. So I wrote it for the public so they can understand how these corporate magicians are doing their tricks.
Well, as you said, research is manipulated and tainted by market interests in this country, particularly, and other countries too, but particularly by a big pharma.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sort of money trail deception that controls everything from research to even continuing education of doctors.
Absolutely.
So, as you say, you spend a great deal. This is a long book. It's very beautifully written. I'm really, really enjoyed reading it. And you spend much of the book unpacking the ways that information is distorted and restricted. And, you know, what comes to my mind then is how on earth did you then find research that you felt you could trust in this environment to counter it?
Yeah, good question, Lena. And you have to be a detective. You have to take information wherever you can find it. In the case of Vioxx, buried on the FDA's website was the actual results that Merck turned into the FDA from its Vigor study. This was completed in March of 2000. And that was that study, the Vigor study, served as the basis of the New England Journal of Medicine's article that was published in November 2000. The problem that I found is that the article in the New England Journal said that Vioxx is a safer drug because it's gentler on the stomach, and by the way, it does cause more heart attacks in people who have a previous history, but not in people who don't have a previous history, so not much worry there. And they measured cardiovascular complications, meaning heart attacks, blood clots, and strokes, but they're not going to report them in this article. When you look at the FDA data, you see a very different picture. you see that naproxen, the patients who got naproxen in this study, which is sold over the counter as Aleve, got equally good relief, but they developed significantly more heart attacks, blood clots, or strokes, whether or not they had a previous history, and significantly more serious complications overall. So if I, as a family doc, prescribed Vioxx for 100 patients in a row instead of naproxen, which is no better symptomatically, I would cause 2.5 serious illnesses in the following year. This is an enormous amount of risk that the FDA and Merck both knew about by the fall of 2000, and the advisory committee meeting was February 2001. After that happened, and this is what I used my brief moments at the most recent FDA advisory committee meeting about this last February, after Merck and the FDA knew about this, American doctors prescribed $7 billion worth of Vioxx that caused about 100,000 heart attacks and deaths after Merck and the FDA knew it was significantly more dangerous than naproxen. That's what American doctors are up against. That's what the American people are up against. And the reason why that happened, Lena, is because the doctors were misinformed by one of their most trusted sources of information, the New England Journal of Medicine.
Dr. Fawcett just handed me a little note saying, are doctors ready now to hear this information?
You know, that's a great question. And the answer is yes, they are, when they hear it in the way that they have been taught to learn. So I've been doing grand rounds all over the country. I just got back from a Michigan State bioethics conference last weekend, and from Vermont the week before. When doctors see the data in black and white, the way we're taught to look at data, it's incontrovertible that the drug companies are controlling our knowledge. If you look at the cholesterol guidelines, if you look at Celebrex and Vioxx, if you look at osteoporosis or antidepressants, virtually any of the best-selling classes of drugs, you see this tremendous commercial infusion of so-called knowledge. When doctors think they're practicing scientific-based medicine, they're really practicing infomercial-based medicine. Now that we've had these debacles that have been public, docs are ready, and when I give grand rounds, it's usually only one or two doctors that are so firmly committed to their frame of reference that they come into the room with, that they can't understand that they're being bamboozled. And the conversation usually turns from a question of what are the facts to what do we do about it now. I was involved in this wonderful scene a couple of weeks ago. I gave an hour talk about the cholesterol guidelines, showing that cholesterol-lowering statin drugs are being prescribed for millions of women and people over 65 when there's no evidence from randomized controlled studies to justify those recommendations. And I gave an hour talk. At the end of the talk, a doc raised his hand and said, you know, I always knew this was true. Now I see that the facts are there, but the insurers make us prescribe this stuff because they give us bad report cards and they turn us into the state if we don't do it. A representative from the biggest insurer in the state got up and said, you know, I know that we're doing that, and we don't want to do it, but if we don't get you to prescribe these drugs, then we get dinged by the national organizations that give us report cards, and we have a legislative obligation to turn you in, at which point a legislative representative got up and said, you know, we don't want to be doing this to you, but we don't control the legislature, and we can't stop it. And for the first time, for everyone in that room, including me, we all got a view of this system that we're trapped in, that won't let well-meaning people practice the kind of medicine that Americans need. You know, Lena, we are spending in the United States twice what the other wealthy industrialized countries spend, and Americans live the shortest amount of time in good health. We're spending twice as much living the shortest amount of time in good health. Our medical system has been taken over to serve these corporate interests and not the health needs of the American people. This is the ultimate issue of a failure of democracy. And if we don't get this straightened out through political means, it's a political problem. If we can't get this straightened out, then I think our democracy just can't work. It's that important.
Well, you know, you just trumped about three of my questions, so thank you. You just covered, because that's one of the areas I was going to go to, is the fact that this is not only a public policy crisis, but a political crisis. And it's, as I said to you on the phone when we talked, it's emblematic of a very large political crisis that's going on in every aspect of American life. So this is just happening here as well as other places, and I think people mistakenly forget to think of medical and health issues as being political, and they are extremely political and very personal.
Absolutely. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, a pro-business Republican, dealt with almost exactly the same issues 100 years ago when the railroad, steel, and oil industries had amassed so much wealth that they could distort markets, make money without providing commensurate social value. And Teddy Roosevelt used his bully pulpit to rebalance the capitalist marketplace. Right now, we need a rebalancing. The drug companies and other medical corporations are leeching off of the rest of the corporations in America and distorting their competitiveness. It can't go on. We've got a very unlikely hero emerging. When the now former commissioner of the FDA was going through his approval hearings about 3 months ago, Senator Kennedy, a Democrat who we would expect to be standing up for the people, said that the FDA is really doing a good job, and if we just give it a little more money, they'll be fine, and voted to approve Dr. Crawford to be commissioner of the FDA. Senator Charles Grassley, who's chairman of the House Senate Finance Committee, Senator Charles Grassley, who's a conservative Republican, said the FDA is muzzling scientific dissent and is in a state of denial under Crawford's leadership and voted against Crawford. And Senator Grassley is ticked, and I think what's happening here is that this issue about the distortion of American medicine is now so important that it transcends Republican and Democrat, and it's turning into a truly populist issue. And I hope it does, because if the Democrats can't be in the lead in this, then they deserve to lose their voice. This is such an egregious situation. We have 45 million Americans who are uninsured. It causes 18,000 deaths a year. Now, that's like a 9/11 tragedy every 2 months. We are the wealthiest country in the world, and we're the only industrialized country that doesn't provide universal health care. 76% of Americans say health care is a right, not a privilege. Somewhere between 2/3 and 80% of Americans say they think all Americans should be insured, and they're willing to pay for it with tax dollars, and our politicians won't allow us to have universal health insurance. There's something very wrong with this.
Bravo. This firebrand that you're listening to is Dr. John Abramson from actually Harvard, on the faculty of Harvard, thank goodness. His book that we're discussing today is Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. There's a couple of things that occur to me that are really crucial to get out, and I feel like I've got you as an insider, and now I've got your ear, and I want you to hear this. One of the things that we talked about on the phone is this issue of what counts as good evidence. And the fact that because we can't now trust good clinical trials, what do we trust? And my sense is that a good example is what I called and talked to you about, which is that you wrote about the debacle of women and pharmaceutical grade hormone replacement. And I agree with you that there's a terrible problem with the way the pharmaceutical companies pushed hormone replacement on women and the methods that they used to supply those hormones. But as I talked to you and we sort of started to unpack the WHI studies together and I told you what I had found, there was information that you were not privy to, which is all the research that was done on bioidentical progesterone and the fact that Provera has always been shown to be a problem, and that actually the second study with the WHI on estrogen actually showed a decrease in breast cancer and a clotting doubled, but there was no progesterone or testosterone on board with these women who had no ovaries or uteruses. So what alarmed me is that you are reading research and you don't know about some of the stuff. So there's such an effective, you know, smackdown of anything that hasn't been funded by a pharmaceutical company. It feels to me as though the whole method of clinical trials is just failing.
Absolutely, Lena. What's happened is over the past 25 years, there's been a very quiet and very radical transformation of the role that medical knowledge plays in society. Before 1980, most clinical trials were funded by the NIH. good researchers could write grants and be confident that their research would be funded. When President Reagan came to town, came to Washington, he inherited a slow economy, and he came with a small government ethos, and he cut the NIH funding for clinical studies. Over the subsequent decade or so, drug company funding went up sixfold. When we got to 1991, 70% of clinical studies were funded by the drug companies, but still nothing had changed. And for the docs out there who were in practice during the 1980s, think back. The journals really didn't change much in the 1980s, even though the funding did. And the reason for that is that 70% of the drug clinical trials were being funded by the drug company, but they were still being done in universities where there were still traditions of checks and balances and intellectual integrity. 80% of that commercially funded research was being done in universities. Things changed radically in the 1990s, so that when we got to 2000, only 34% of commercially funded research was being done in universities. The rest had been pulled out and was being done by contract research organizations or for-profit research companies. Now, there's nothing inherently unethical about that. It's the American business way of finding the most efficient way to do your business. But the problem is that when the drug companies contracted directly with the research companies, it gave the drug companies virtually complete control over how the studies were designed, over how the data was analyzed, over who gets to see the data, because many of the authors of the articles in our best journals don't even get to see their data, and whether it's published or not. So now we've got a situation where three-quarters of the clinical studies that are funded in our best journals, Lancet, New England Journal, and JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, 3 out of 4 of the clinical studies are funded by the drug companies. And we know that if you look at those studies, the odds are 5 times greater that commercially funded clinical studies will find their sponsor's product, the treatment of choice, compared to non-commercially funded research. So what we've got now is a virtual takeover of the machinery that generates our clinical knowledge. And it keeps going on because doctors are guided by clinical practice guidelines. They get report cards on them, and we may not be good critical thinkers, but we sure know how to get to good grades. So we get graded on them, and clinical practice guidelines are admissible in court as evidence in malpractice cases. So there's a tremendous imperative for us to follow clinical practice guidelines. Well, it turns out 59% of the experts who participate in writing those clinical practice guidelines have active financial ties to a drug company that has a drug that's being decided upon.
What a surprise.
And then we look at continuing education that we have to go to maintain our state licenses, and we find 70% of the clinical continuing education is now funded by the drug company. So what we get, Lena, is a situation where our medical knowledge grows towards profits the way that plants grow towards sunlight. And issues like bioidentical hormones and issues like how we help people to live healthier lives and how we help people to be proactive in their environments, to control violence, to participate in the political process, how we do all those things get pushed aside because there aren't quick profits to be made on them.
Additionally, if you medicalize every symptom that a person has in their lives, then the stress that people are already under becomes medicalized and treatable with a drug, and it becomes a disease, which is the whole biomedical model. And then you've got people who are literally not functioning because they're already under stress, and now they're taking 6 or 8 or even 10 medications that are interacting with each other and turning them into sort of blow-up dolls, you know.
That's exactly right. And you hear, well, ask your doctor. The problem is that the sources of information that your doctor has been trained to trust, the medical journals, the guidelines, the experts at continuing education, have all been infused by drug company paid experts and writers and researchers. So we've got a situation where we don't have access to accurate information. It's almost like we're running our healthcare system on counterfeit knowledge, which in a knowledge economy is exactly like printing counterfeit money. And the money is being made. Our healthcare system works magnificently to generate the maximum profits for the vested interests, but very poorly to improve the health of the American people.
Well, it's clear that until market forces are actually removed from medical model. Things won't change.
Mm-hmm. And the tragedy of this, Lena, is that the vast majority of doctors went into medicine because they want to help people, and they still want to help people, and they're not able to get the information that they need. Let me give you an example. There is not a shred of evidence from randomized controlled studies that cholesterol-lowering drugs benefit women who don't have heart disease already.
I'm not sure it benefits men either.
There are shades of gray. They're light gray, but there are shades of gray. But for women, there's not a shred. There's not an argument. It's over. It's a slam dunk. There is no evidence. And we do know from the Nurses Health Study that women who do five simple things, who exercise regularly, eat a Mediterranean-style diet, don't smoke, drink in moderation, and maintain a reasonable body weight, just those five simple things, have 83% less heart disease than women who don't do those things. But only 3% of American women do those five healthy habits. Now, doctors believe that they're no good at helping women to move towards a healthy lifestyle. Nothing could be further from the truth. There's very good scientific evidence that doctors participating in a program of helping people towards healthy lifestyle change play a major role. But there's this sort of wisdom on the street that you got to believe starts with some PR campaign somewhere. But there's this wisdom on the street that doctors can't help people. Hogwash. Doctors can help people, and that's what doctors should be doing, because the best information from the Institute of Medicine is that about 70% of preventable deaths are caused by lifestyle and environmental factors. Now, if doctors' job is to improve the health of their patients, how can we go forward without taking into account 70% of the factors that affect people's health? It's nuts.
It's nuts, but it's also not just lifestyle. If somebody lives in a neighborhood where they have to take a bus to get mm-hmm. a head of lettuce, you know, they can mm-hmm. buy crack out the front door, but they can't get a head of lettuce, and there's no place to walk in the neighborhood, and it's unsafe to be outside, and these are impoverished people who are working at substandard wages and have no medical care. How on earth are we going to expect these people to eat a Mediterranean diet and get more exercise?
You're exactly right. And
plus, you know, the stress of that is what it is one of the cascades that causes terrible illness.
Absolutely. You're totally right.
Yeah.
And every survey I see says that the American people believe that that should not be happening. But our politicians won't let that situation get rectified.
Well, you know, we're going to have to take a brief break, and let's come back to our interview. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. If you missed parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can go to the website or call 707-874-2772. You can also actually hear this show all week at the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, in an archive form. And on the website, you'll also find information about the website and benefits of joining Your Own Health and Fitness as well. So let's get back to our interview with Dr. John Abramson, author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. Where we left off was just talking about how much doctors are under terrible pressure by this kind of sort of train that's running on this track and all these regulations on them, and how much market forces are controlling what doctors hear and what they need to do. Even if they don't diagnose drugs, sometimes they get into trouble. I'm wondering also whether the doctor role of doctor and patient, where the doctor can, you know, suggest some non-invasive treatments and changes in the way you eat, or certainly exercise, which I've always felt is convincing, whether it shows up in research or not. It's convincing because people feel better, and my experience is that they do live longer, and there's also wonderful research in the frail elderly. So I'm a great believer in not using pharmaceuticals first, but addressing nutrient deficiencies and getting on with getting people moving. But I think the doctor's roles are being overshadowed by the PR and the ads, wouldn't you say?
That's absolutely true, Lena. What's happening is those the advertisements that bombard us, we see an average of 10 a day on television, for those of you who do have a television, they're just destroying our health care in two ways. And it's important to remember that the United States and tiny New Zealand of less than 4 million people are the only two industrialized countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising. The rest of the countries think it's pretty bizarre to have advertisements for prescription drugs that the use of which ought to be based on considered scientific judgment being hawked to the public with butterflies and cartoons and emotional music in the background to try and make people feel good. It's a ridiculous situation. But what's happening is the drug companies claim that they're providing an educational service. Well, that's true if you define education as teaching people to buy more of their expensive products. But there's very little truth to it if you define education as motivating people, as transferring information that motivates people to take action that will lead to their improving their health. So what happens is it's just commercially valuable information that gets transferred to people with an emotional message of this consumer pseudo-autonomy that convinces people through the mastery of advertising to express their autonomy and their sense of power by demanding these drugs of doctors. Now, the studies are very clear that when patients go to doctors and request drugs, 45 to 80% of the time, they get those drugs. The doctors grant the request. But doctors are ambivalent that that's the right choice 50% of the time when doctors request the drug, and only 12% of the time when the doctor prescribes the drug himself or herself. So what you get is a displacement of good medicine, and most importantly, you squander the opportunities to provide real health care between doctor and patient. But most importantly, what these ads do is drive a wedge between doctors and patients. So instead of building a trusting relationship that's based on the patient's concerns and values and symptoms and medical condition, what we get is a win-lose situation. The Nobel Prize just went to game theory people. What we get is a game set up where there's a winner and a loser, whether the prescription drug is prescribed or not, instead of a partnership to help people's health. And that's really undermining health care in the United States.
Well, it also brings up another question, which is whether MD should be the first front of primary prevention and whether or not this is, in fact, a public health problem.
Good question. And I think you raise an excellent point, Lena, because I think it should be shared. In terms of providing public education and creating a culture of health, clearly that's a public health issue. Now, my observations are, from what I know about anthropology, there's always been identified healers in societies. And I believe that we human beings are hardwired to go to culturally empowered healers. The problem is that those healing relationships in our current environment are being exploited by the drug companies and are providing unhealing therapies instead of the doctors being able to fulfill the role that they chose as being true healers. And part of the problem has to do with docs being taught in medical school that human beings are really no more than chemistry and physics, machines, forgetting that human beings are also something ineffable, some sort of existential, sentient being. Some people say soul or spirit. But human beings are not just the molecules and atoms that make up their bodies. Human beings have a sense of values and meaning and pleasure and pride and caring and love. And if those factors aren't taken into account in their health care, then docs can't help their patients to move towards healthier lifestyles and healthier environments. And that's the real tragedy of the commercial takeover of our medical knowledge, is that doctors are being excluded from stepping up to the plate in their role as healers, and patients are being victimized, thinking that they're getting the best health care when they may be getting the most expensive health care and the glitziest health care, but they're not getting the health care that's going to lead them towards better health.
Well, in addition, there's that sort of issue of not only are people, and as you say, ineffable, and I would say animals too, but they're individuals, and that sort of medical thing of if it trots and neighs, it's a horse, when in fact a certain assembly of symptoms may in fact not lead to the same conclusion, and unless people are looking at individuals and their lifestyle and their stress and their family situation and their socioeconomic status and all the rest of it, you know, thrown in and what sort of unresolved infections they might have, this might not be a horse that you're diagnosing. In other words, it may not come to the same conclusion. So this business of, like I said earlier, medicalizing everything instead of, as you say, thinking when someone came in with a tennis elbow, well, let's change your stroke. Let's try this brace at certain times. Let's try a little ice. Let's do some, you know, maybe someone who can't walk anymore should swim. You know, the most obvious sort of loving kind of care that people don't think of immediately because of the medicalization of our society and all the smoke screens, you know, like you talk about all the different things that have been turned into disease that are actually treatable with exercise changes and not smoking, which you hammer on, and I just can't get over how many people still smoke. Oh. And the alcohol problems and the rush toward taking pharmaceuticals and then ending up with a whole raft of them interacting with each other instead of just doing the most obvious simple things of dietary changes and moving and getting sleep.
Absolutely, Lena. Mm. You know, I think one thing that's really lost in medical education is the doctors are taught the so-called medical gaze, that detached look that you're looking on a non-sentient machine when you're looking at a patient. One of the things that's lost is the medical version of the saying, you can't cross the same river twice, because a good doctor never crosses the same patient twice, never. It can be a strep throat, it can be high blood pressure, it can be anything that looks the same, but every single patient is different and has different concerns and needs and needs different kind of care.
My last question is, will universal health care, this is actually, some of these questions are coming from Jeff Fawcett, but will universal health care move to defang Big Pharma? I mean, there's a big issue here. It's nice we can do universal health care, but how are we going to get this influence out?
Yeah, Jeff, you hit the nail right on the head. You know, I think it's a real mystery. How come we're the wealthiest country and somewhere between three-quarters and four-fifths of us think that universal health care ought to happen now and are willing to pay for it? Why don't we have it? I think that the problem, the impediment to getting universal health care is if we had it, the public would demand that our medical knowledge bring us to the most effective and efficient health care instead of the most profitable health care. So I think that the pharmaceutical industry and the other medical industries, the MRI makers and the CAT scan makers and the defibrillator makers and everything else, I think that they know that they're at the point on their price and volume curve where they're going to get the most profits. And if they try to expand the market into a segment of our population that's going to require more public funding, that the jig's going to be up, and, you know, the emperor's new clothes are going to be exposed, or the curtain behind the covering the Wizard of Oz is going to get pulled, and we're going to see that the truth is that about a third of the medical care that's being prescribed, a third of our medical care now in the United States is unnecessary and or harmful. And when that gets known publicly, I mean, this is from research done at Dartmouth Medical School, showing that across Medicare regions, there's a 60% variation. The regions that provide more care have higher mortality rates, no higher quality, no higher satisfaction, and no better access. And overall, about 30 to 33% of our medical care is unnecessary or harmful. Well, 30% of our medical care, our medical bill each year is $1.9 trillion. 30% of that is over $600 billion a year we are wasting right now on unnecessary care that's often harmful. That $600 billion is more than the U.S. Defense Department is spending, even with our little venture in Iraq going on. It's an enormous amount of money that's being wasted, and it's being siphoned off in high-cost, high-profit medical care. Jeff, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, when you say if we have universal health care, isn't that going to put in a demand to straighten our medical knowledge? And the answer is yes, I think it will. And that's why we all need to fight. We all need to do everything we can to get universal health care because it's the right thing to do, because most people, most Americans, believe in social justice, and because it's going to bring us all better health care.
Dr. Abramson, I have to let you go, regrettably. I so enjoyed interviewing you, and I hope that we'll have another opportunity to do some more of this. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. John Abramson, Overdosed America, the Broken Promise of American Medicine.
Elena, it's been a pleasure to be with you. And let me just say one thing. If you do buy the book or get it as a gift, please read it and pass it on to your doctor, because your doctor's got to get this information.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information 24 hours a day, information number at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, and news about the nonprofit and the benefits of membership, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Vinnie Beecham. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.